Have you ever seen one of those puzzle pictures that they put in children's books? One I remember very clearly is, if you see it one way, looking at it as black on white, it's two silhouette profiles of two faces looking at one another. But if you blink a few times and look at it another way as white on black, it becomes the silhouette of a candlestick. Have you seen that? I remember finding it once in an encyclopedia as a child and being most excited by it. My problem came when I tried to share my discovery with my sister. My sister is not a particularly stupid girl, but for some reason or another, she just could not see the two faces. No matter how many times I made her blink, no matter how carefully I pointed out the noses and the mouth and the chins, she couldn't see it. It was really frustrating. I've experienced a similar frustration sometimes, talking to my friends and trying to persuade them to believe in Jesus. It all seems so obvious to me. Can't understand anyone failing to appreciate the sense in it all. And yet so often they are unable to share my perception of things. Why can't they see it? I find myself asking. How can I convince them? Maybe that's your experience too. Whether like me as a Christian, trying unsuccessfully to communicate your faith to others, or maybe from the other side of the fence, as an unbeliever, trying unsuccessfully to understand what these crazy Christians are going on about. Well, if so, perhaps our Bible reading this morning may help us. Because you see, it contains one of the finest apologetic sermons that the Apostle Paul ever preached. By apologetic, of course, I don't mean that he was in any way embarrassed by his Christian faith or wanted to say sorry for it. I'm using the word in the more technical sense of an apologia, a speech in defense of something. An apologetic sermon is one in which the preacher tries to argue his hearers into the truth of his convictions. And nowhere does Paul try harder in that regard than here in Acts chapter 26. One reason, of course, is because, as we saw last week, he's on trial for his life. And the knowledge that you're going to be hanged in a fortnight does concentrate the mind wonderfully, as someone has said. He's already, in fact, spoken three times in his own defense. First to the Jewish crowd, who came close to lynching him, back in Acts 22. Then, in Acts 23, to the Supreme Jewish Council, who came very close to tearing him limb from limb, you remember. And then before the Roman governor, Felix, who couldn't make up his mind and left him for 2 years in jail. Well, now, however, he faces his greatest challenge of all, because Felix, at long last, has been transferred to another part of the empire, and his successor, Festus, has reopened Paul's case. After the preliminary hearing in Acts 25 that we read, he quickly comes to the conclusion that Paul isn't facing normal criminal charges. It is simply that he's upset the Jewish authorities by propounding some preposterous notion, but to them clearly highly offensive also, about, as he puts it, a dead man called Jesus. In strict justice, Festus knew he should dismiss the case. But that was easier said than done, because the Jewish establishment who were pressing these charges against Paul were very influential people, and he was a very new governor. He needed their support. So Festus was feeling sorely tempted to sacrifice justice on the altar of political expediency and hand Paul, his prisoner, over to the Jews for trial as a goodwill gesture, to do them a favour, as Luke puts it. But such a suggestion didn't commend itself in any way to Paul, who was a realist and knew he would stand about as much chance of winning a case against the Jerusalem judiciary as David Gower does of winning a test match against the West Indians. He quickly saw that if Festus's impartiality couldn't be relied upon, he really had only one hope. And that was to use his right as a Roman citizen to appeal to Caesar, to request that his case be heard personally by the emperor. And one senses it with some sigh of relief that Festus seizes upon this way out of his tricky corner. You've appealed to Caesar, he says in verse 12, to Caesar you will go. Now, at last, he could get rid of this troublesome prisoner without risking a political storm over it. But Festus's problems were not completely over. Because, you see, you couldn't send a prisoner to Rome without a full dossier of accompanying papers. You know what the civil service is like. There were endless forms to fill in. And Festus, being a bit of a novice as far as Jewish affairs was concerned, he'd only been there a couple of weeks, he was really completely flummoxed about what he ought to write in this report. So, with masterly diplomacy, he invites a second opinion. And the consultant he chooses is none less than Herod Agrippa II. It was, I say, a most important encounter as far as Paul was concerned. You see, Agrippa was constitutionally the secular head of the Jewish people. He was the Roman representative in Judea. It was he, for instance, who had the prerogative to appoint the high priest. So the influence he wielded in Jerusalem was enormous. The Jewish authorities who were pressing these charges had to take notice of Herod, if they wanted to get on, that was. On the other hand, it also meant that this king had the ear of many important people in the Roman Empire at large, including, of course, the emperor himself. So if Agrippa could be persuaded to take a sympathetic line towards Paul's case, it could mean two things. It would, first of all, be a huge step towards guaranteeing Christianity's legal status and official protection within the Roman Empire. And secondly, it would be a vital point of entry for the gospel into social circles which up till then were largely untouched. But as far as the missionary expansion of the church was concerned, it was a strategic opportunity, and Paul knew it. He'd never faced a more important challenge. And yet, of course, speaking before Agrippa was not going to be easy. Quite apart from anything else, he represented a very daunting audience. Look at how Luke describes the entry of Agrippa and his sister Bernice, or Veronica as we would call her. Agrippa and Bernice came in with great pomp and entered the audience room with the high-ranking officials and the leading men of the city. So it wasn't just a private little audience, nice and cozy, on the hearthrug with Agrippa and his sister. No, Festus was making a real occasion out of it. They all came in their royal regalia, and not just the royal family themselves. There were the auditorium was full, in addition, of all the army brass and the civil service pinstripe. The aristocracy had turned out in force, whether out of diplomatic protocol or sheer curiosity. They'd all accepted their governor's invitation to come to the show. No wonder Paul uses the word pomp there, fantasia, to describe the scene. The pageantry must have been a bit like the royal opening of Parliament. Only, of course, on this occasion, it wasn't the Queen's speech that all come to hear, was it? It was Paul's. Not only was he a daunting audience, this fellow Agrippa, though, he was also very informed. Look at verses 2 and 3 of chapter 26. "You are well acquainted," he says, "with all the Jewish customs and controversies." Now, that wasn't just flannel on Paul's part. He didn't use flannel, as we saw last week. Herod Agrippa II belonged to a royal family that had been intimately involved in Middle Eastern politics for nearly a century, and particularly Jewish affairs. It's true that Festus was a pagan Gentile. When it came to understanding Christianity, he started at square one. But not Agrippa. Agrippa knew the Bible inside out. He knew Judaism inside out. And it's more than likely that he knew a fair bit about Christianity, too. After all, his great-grandfather had been Herod the Great. He was the man who had met the wise men from the East. And his father, Herod Agrippa I, he'd been the man who executed John the Baptist, who'd interviewed Jesus just before his execution, who'd ordered the execution of one of Jesus' leading disciples, James. It's hard to believe that the young Agrippa hadn't discussed these things with his father. Few non-Christians were better informed about this so-called sect of the Nazarenes than Agrippa was. Paul, even if he'd wished to do so, would not have been able to pull the wool over this man's eyes. Agrippa already had a pretty good grasp of what the key issues were, and it seems quite a lively interest in them. For he says to Festus, "I'd like to hear this man for myself." So it was a daunting audience and an informed audience. On top of all that, I suspect, it was likely to be a rather critical audience. And you see, Paul wasn't preaching to urban slaves and rural peasants now. He was preaching at Sandringham. This was royalty. Agrippa had finished his education in Rome. He'd attended Nero's court there. He had heard there some of the most famous orators of the period, even the legendary Seneca, the man who had written the classic textbook on rhetoric. So Paul's grammar and elocution would have to be at their very best if he wasn't to be written off as some illiterate barbarian. No dropping your H's this time, Paul. No split infinitives. In fact, if you read this text in the original language carefully, it's quite clear that Paul does lift his standard of Greek quite noticeably, consciously adapting to the occasion, speaking far more classical grammar, far more classical vocabulary than he usually does for the benefit of his sophisticated audience. But of course, it wouldn't just be his style the audience would be critically evaluating. It would be his content, too. For these would be people who had heard the finest lawyers in Europe arguing their cases. What kind of defense could Paul offer? So I say it was a challenge. Paul's ability as a Christian apologist was being tested to the limit. I don't suppose in all his career Paul had ever tried to convince anyone of the validity of the Christian message harder than he tried to convince Agrippa of it. And of course, in doing so, he has left us with a most instructive model. A model for those of us who find that same exercise, albeit in more modest circumstances, of defending our faith, quite frustrating sometimes. I want to simplify the outline on the bulletin a bit and just give you three headings as we look at the second part of Acts 26 this morning. I want you to notice, first of all, the use Paul makes of reason. Secondly, I want you to notice the use he makes of evidence. And finally, I want you to notice the use he makes of appeal. Let's start with the use he makes of reason. Now look closely at verses 24 and 25. Festus, at one point in his defense, can't stand it any longer. This is far too obscure for a limited Latin intelligence like his. "You're out of your mind, Paul," he shouts. "Your great learning is driving you insane." Now notice what he replies. "I am not insane, most excellent Festus. What I am saying is true and reasonable." I remember in the days before I joined their ranks, finding Christians very irritating. And the most irritating thing about them was the inane arguments they used to try and get me converted. The discussion would go something like this. "Roy, you're not happy, are you?" "No, perhaps I'm not very happy." "You should become a Christian. Christians have joy." "Roy, you're anxious, aren't you?" "More than likely. Exams are a little bit worrying. You should become a Christian. Christians have peace." "Roy, you've got no direction in life, have you?" "None at all. Haven't the foggiest idea what I'm going to do." "You should become a Christian. Christians have purpose." It was a line of reasoning I found wholly unconvincing, and I told them so. "It's just as I thought," I said to them. "Faith for you Christians is just a pathetic psychological prop. I'm not going to believe just to feel joy. Perhaps the world is sad. I'm not going to believe just to experience peace. Perhaps the world is troubled. I'm not going to believe just to find purpose. Perhaps the world is meaningless. There's only one thing that will persuade me to accept your Christian faith," I said to them, "and that is if I thought it was true." And truth, for me, meant far more than the mere satisfaction of my so-called spiritual needs. Truth meant factuality. It meant that this God they talked about, this Jesus they talked about, this heaven and hell they talked about, that these things really existed. Something more concrete than convenient figments of human imagination. And I regret to say that as far as those early Christian acquaintances of mine were concerned, at least, truth didn't seem very high on their agenda. I realise now that in some ways this was simply due to the fact that they were rather more avant-garde than I was. I mean, being a physical scientist, I was intellectually at least 50 years behind the times. I was still rather contemptuous of subjective human feelings. Logical proofs and empirical evidences were what counted for me. Truth was something you discovered by laboratory experiments or computer programs. At that time of my life, I read very few novels and still less poetry. And I bore my reputation as a cultural Philistine with considerable pride. I realize now I was behind the times, because the myth of the all-sufficiency of science had been long since exploded, years before. There are many questions in this world that laboratories and computers couldn't answer, especially the big questions, like why are we here? What should we do with our lives? Scientific data, for all its commendable objectivity, isn't the sum total of reality. There are some things thermometers can't measure and telescopes can't probe. And that's why the work of artists and writers is significant, even though it may come completely out of their imagination sometimes. But you see, in my semi-literate state of over-specialization, I was unaware of all these things. I still lived in the fantasy world of 18th and 19th century rationalism, where science could explain everything. And anything it couldn't explain was by definition non-existent. Was it Leibniz who said, "Give me matter and motion and I will make the universe"? That was my ambition too. It was arrogant and wholly untenable, I realize now. If my friends had been a bit better read, I think they'd have been able to explain to me, sir. Nevertheless, I have to say in my own defense that I still believe I was justified in feeling irritated with those Christians and the arguments they were using. Of course, truth is much larger than my scientific prejudice was prepared to admit at that time. But there is still a difference, isn't there, between fact and fiction. Christianity makes some extraordinary claims. It says, if you believe in Jesus Christ, if you put your trust in him and repent of your sins, you will receive the gift of eternal life. Now, that is either true, a scientific, objective fact, or it is not. If it isn't true, then no matter what comfort I may gain from believing in it, I'm quite literally living in a fool's paradise. Any joy or peace I may discover in prospect of this eternal bliss are as futile as the euphoria of a drug addict. Any sense of purpose I may feel in my life as a result of this Christian hope are as whimsical as the delusions of a schizophrenic. Undoubtedly, I was being a bit unfair to my non-Christian friends in complaining about all this talk about peace and joy and purpose, and insisting that instead they prove Christianity to me scientifically, as I put it. I should have been more conscious of the limitations of scientific method. But I wasn't being unfair in demanding some kind of rational and objective foundation for these outrageous propositions that they were affirming. In the absence of such concrete facts, such logical arguments, there really was very little difference between believing in Jesus and believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden. I believed that then, and I believe it now. Perhaps that's the problem of somebody here this morning. You've talked to Christians, you've been to some extent impressed by their sincerity. Maybe you feel some stirrings of spiritual need in your own heart. Maybe you would even go so far as to say you would like to believe in Christianity if only you could. But is it true? That's the question that haunts you. Is it true? How do I know the whole thing isn't a mammoth confidence trick? I think Paul would have sympathized with that question. He would have regarded it as a very valid one. And the reason I say that is, well, look, here he is before a most distinguished and educated audience. He desperately wants to present the case for Christianity as convincingly as he can. What is the key issue that he focuses around? Is it the peace and the joy and the purpose that men find through faith in Christ? Now, what I want you to notice is that the dominant note Paul strikes all the way through this apologia is the rationality and the factuality of the gospel. For Paul, Christianity wasn't just a subjective experience of peace and joy. It wasn't just a psychological focus of personal significance. Christianity was true and reasonable, he says. I don't think it's possible to exaggerate the importance of that. Of course, Christians do believe some pretty difficult and incredible things. There's a hymn in our hymn book by Isaac Watts about the Trinity, and the closing lines are, "Where reason fails with all her powers, there faith prevails and love adores." Every Christian understands what he means by that. There's no point in pretending that doctrines like the Trinity or the Atonement or the Incarnation don't enshrine unfathomable mysteries. How could God be God and not defy the grasp of our finite and feeble little minds sometimes? And because of that element of mystery, it's not a surprise that sometimes, on first contact with Christian teaching, some may well be inclined to think Christians are mad for believing such things, as Festus did. "Too much study has turned your mind, Paul," he says. "You've been too long in your books. Come down to earth." But a Christian's reply to that accusation of insanity or fanaticism must be the same as Paul's was. An emphatic denial. "You're wrong, Festus. There's nothing insane about Christians at all. For there is all the difference in the world between a mystery that goes beyond human reason and a nonsense which goes against it." Paul was convinced that whilst the gospel undoubtedly contained the former, it had none of the latter. On the contrary, there were good reasons for believing the gospel. Not proof in the scientific sense, it's true, but reasons nevertheless. And that is why, you see, whenever you read the sermons of Paul in the book of Acts, and especially this one, you'll find that they are full of argument, full of logic, full of debate. Paul, in fact, expresses his evangelistic strategy in his letter to the Corinthians like this. "We have renounced secret, shameful ways," he says. "We don't use deception. We don't distort things. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God." That was his policy, he says. No emotionalism for Paul, no obscurantism, no mysticism. "What I am saying to you," he says, "is true and reasonable." I say, I can't stress enough the importance of that. It's important for those of us who are Christians, first of all, who want to communicate our faith effectively. For it means we can't be satisfied with simplistic appeals to the subjective benefits of faith. Peace and joy and purpose and the like. Such things are great, and nobody can deny them. But a biblical apologetic must be more concerned about confronting men with the truth of the gospel, rather than with enticing them with its blessings. What God requires of us isn't glib sales talk, but reasoned argument. If we cannot offer the world that, we don't understand what Paul meant by evangelism. But it's important, too, for anybody here who is a non-Christian and who is interested in finding faith. Let me say to you as emphatically as I possibly can, you do not have to commit intellectual suicide to become a Christian. A humanist once defined faith as an illogical belief in the improbable. Well, it may be a little funny, but it's wrong. Compelling myself to believe in the unbelievable is no part of true religion. I became a Christian under the constraint of the truth. Jesus said, "I am the truth." I didn't give up the quest for truth and receive Jesus instead. It was as the truth Jesus wanted to be accepted. There is nothing blind about my faith. It is a reasoning trust. No matter how many Christians we may meet then who by their attitude or by their methods seem to suggest the contrary, I ask you to believe me. No, I ask you to believe the Apostle Paul when he says there is nothing anti-intellectual about the Christian message. On the contrary, it is true, he says, and reasonable. And if you study his sermon here carefully, you will, I think, discover that there is one factor in that Christian message which demonstrates and establishes that factuality and that rationality more convincingly than any other. Look back at verse 8. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? And that brings us to the second thing I want us to talk about, the use Paul makes of evidence. See, Christianity didn't begin with a group of men discovering the same religious idea or sharing the same religious experience even. Christianity began when a group of men saw the same event. They presented themselves to the world not as philosophers or mystics. They said they were witnesses, eyewitnesses, witnesses of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That's how it began. Now, of course, some of you may know that in recent years, Christian theologians have become more and more embarrassed about that. Perhaps you've heard all about this debate in the Church of England, which has even reached the national newspapers, about David Jenkins, the Bishop of Durham, whose appointment was marked by such, I'm tempted to say, fiery controversy. Well, he's a typical case in point. Like many liberal Christian thinkers, he has reservations about pinning his faith to what happened on that first Easter Sunday. Now, sometimes this reluctance is born of a very modern antipathy towards any kind of rational basis for faith at all. Faith, say some, is more authentic without arguments to back it up. Faith is a splendidly irrational leap into the existential void, say some. For others, perhaps rather more, is more a question of not wishing to jeopardize faith by making it the victim of historical criticism. After all, everybody knows history is so vulnerable to scholarship. What if some modern historian comes along and proves Jesus didn't rise from the dead? What would happen to Christianity then? You know, I think at the root of all this debate about faith and history that's characterized theology for the last 200 years or more, really, I think if you get right to the root of it, you find the most important factor of all is simply a suspicion about the supernatural. Ever since the Enlightenment, ever since the rise of modern science, it's become fashionable in intellectual circles to pour scorn on miracles. Miracles are unscientific. Miracles are superstitious. Only primitive people could ever believe in miracles. Modern man can't be expected to believe in them. That sort of thing. The classic expression of this kind of scepticism you can trace, I think, back to a man called David Hume, who was a philosopher and a historian at the beginning of the 18th century. He wrote a great deal about miracles, all of it against them. And he had two principal arguments that he used. The first was a theoretical one. A miracle, he says, is by definition such an improbable event that any other explanation of what happened is automatically more likely. That was his first argument. And the second argument was a practical one. The witnesses, he says, of all the miracles that have ever happened in practice or supposed to have happened in practice are always biased or naive or both. Let me just read you a little bit from one of his books where you get the flavour of it. There is not to be found, he says, in all history, any miracle attested by a sufficient number of men of such unquestioned good sense, education and learning as to secure us against all delusion in themselves, of such undoubted integrity as to place them beyond all suspicion of design to deceive others, of such credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind as to have a great deal to lose in the case of their being detected in any falsehood, and at the same time attesting facts performed in such a public manner and in so celebrated a part of the world as to render their detection in fraud unavoidable. And Christian theology has, I think, laboured under the shadow of this kind of sceptical opinion for two centuries. Many a fine mind, I fear, has been unnecessarily prejudiced by it. But of course the fact is, it's not true. It is not true that no miracle has ever been attested by these criteria which Hume lays down. The Apostle Paul is explicitly contradicting every item in Hume's impeachment in his sermon here. In his apologetic, the resurrection of Christ, he's saying, is just such a miracle as Hume claimed is not to be found in all history. Just look at the evidence he cites. First of all, there's the evidence of his personal testimony, verse 13. O king, as I was on the road, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. We all fell to the ground. And I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. And then I asked, Who are you, Lord? I am Jesus, the Lord replied. Now, was Paul a biased witness? Was he naive or ignorant? Oh, nonsense. The very opposite is the case. Even Festus recognizes him as a man of immense learning and scholarship in this address. And Paul himself confesses to a fanatical prejudice against the Christian faith at the outset of this journey to Damascus. He had every reason for convincing himself that Jesus was not alive. He had everything to lose by coming to the conclusion that he was alive. But Paul's testimony is this, that he saw him with his own eyes and he heard him with his own ears. And that as the God he served was witness, his mission in life was simply to be obedient to that heavenly vision. Beyond the evidence of his personal testimony, he mentions to Agrippa too the evidence of the Bible. Look at verses 22 and 23. I am saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen. That the Christ would suffer, and as the first to rise from the dead, would proclaim light to his own people and to the Gentiles. Hume claimed, you see, that resurrections and such things were always such improbable events that no amount of evidence would be enough. Which I suppose you might regard to be true if the resurrection were an arbitrary and isolated event. But Paul is saying here it isn't. Rightly understood, the resurrection of Jesus is an expected miracle. Think of it this way. Someone came to you today and said they'd seen somebody walking on water at the River Cam. Well, you might well be disposed to be sceptical. You might well agree with Hume that such a thing is so improbable that there's more likely to be some other explanation. But suppose you discover that this man who was supposed to have walked on the water on the River Cam was no ordinary man. Suppose you discovered that miracles, in fact, followed this man around all his life. From his very birth, people had been predicating miraculous things of him. Supposing you discovered, in fact, that all that was happening to this man had, in fact, been predicted centuries before by those whom a very large section of the human population held to be divinely inspired. Wouldn't that make a bit of a difference to your assessment of the probability of a miracle in his case? In all likelihood, at this particular point in the sermon, Paul goes on to recite text upon text, which Luke doesn't bother to repeat, all from the Old Testament, and all proving to Agrippa that Jesus' death and resurrection and the subsequent mission of the church to Jew and Gentile, that it was all there in the prophets, all predicted. Far from being an improbable event, then, to those who knew the Bible and believed it, the resurrection was an anticipated event. It fitted in completely with a salvation history which God had already foretold. It made eminently good sense to those who knew their Bibles. And thirdly, he cites the evidence of common knowledge. And perhaps for some of us, this will be the most important of all. Verse 25. The king is familiar with these things. I can speak freely to him. I am convinced none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. David Hume complained that miracles were never sufficiently public events to ensure detection of fraud. Paul is saying explicitly the opposite here. The resurrection of Jesus was no private seance. It happened in a city full of people, with dozens, nay, hundreds of witnesses to confirm it. The authorities knew all about it. Everybody knew all about it. What alternative explanation is David Hume going to offer, which is more probable? Is he going to say it was a hoax? So the apostles died in the arena or at the stake for what they knew was a confidence trick? Is he going to say they saw a ghost or hallucination? Or so the body of Jesus was there all the time in the tomb, was it, for anybody who wanted to exhume it? Is he going to say that Jesus was never really dead? So he survived the flogging, the exposure, the strangulation, the blood loss, the complete lack of food, and 48 hours later, he unwinds the bandages that bound his limbs together. He pushes the boulder away from the tomb. He overpowers the Jewish guard. He walks 14 miles to Emmaus and back. And at the end of it all, he presents himself to his disciples, not as a sick man, but as the Lord of life. Paul puts the same question to us, you see, as he put to that audience 2,000 years ago. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead? The real reason David Hume regarded it as incredible was not because the evidence was inadequate, but because he didn't believe in God. And he had no intention of believing in God. For an atheist, of course miracles are incredible. For an atheist, of course any explanation is a better explanation. Because once a miracle has happened, atheism is dead, isn't it? But to those with less prejudiced minds, to those who are less sure about the inviolability of so-called scientific law, to those who are open to the possibility of a divine intervention into our world, for them the possibility of a miracle must be countenanced. And this was one which, in Paul's own day, was common knowledge. So much so that he could appeal to an unbeliever's awareness of the newspapers to confirm it. You're familiar with these things. It hasn't escaped your attention, Agrippa. It wasn't done in a corner, he says. You've got to remember, the first Christian sermon was not preached in London or New York 20 centuries after the event. The first Christian sermon was preached in Jerusalem, where the witnesses could be cross-examined, where the empty tomb could be investigated, where hostile Jewish authorities had every opportunity to present counter-evidence, and all within a matter of just weeks of the event. And at the end of that sermon, you don't find 3,000 skeptics like David Hume. You find 3,000 converts like the Apostle Paul. Wasn't done in a corner, you see. And I suggest to you that still today the evidence of the resurrection of Christ is there for those who want to see it. Primarily in the witness of the apostles, the eyewitnesses in their documents, but also in the contemporary lives of Christians that you may meet. Now, Dr. Ironside, an evangelist, was once publicly challenged in San Francisco to debate with a fellow called Arthur Morrow Lewis, who was a celebrated agnostic. The preacher thought a little while, and then he replied like this to the agnostic. He said, "Sir, I will gladly accept your challenge, but to prove that you have something worth debating, I do so on two conditions. First, that you promise to bring with you to this debate a man who was once a slave to evil, who on some occasion heard you lecture on agnosticism, and was so helped by it that he cast away his sins and became a new man and is today a respected member of society. And secondly, that you agree to bring with you a woman once lost to all purity and goodness, who can now testify how agnosticism has rid her of her degradation and vice and restored to her her chastity. If, sir, you will agree to these conditions, I will promise to be there with at least 100 men and women who were once just such lost souls, but whom the power of the living Christ has transformed and redeemed. Will you accept my terms?" And Lewis is reputed to have shaken his head. And the evidence of the resurrection is still there. But he wasn't willing to accept it any more than David Hume was willing to accept it. Tragically, any more than Agrippa was willing to accept it. And that brings us to the last thing I want you to notice here. Paul's use of personal appeal. King Agrippa, verse 27, "Do you believe in the prophets? I know you do." Then Agrippa said to Paul, "Do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" Paul replied, "Short time or long, I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains." Paul had used reason. He'd cited evidence. And I think there can be little doubt that in his heart Agrippa was being touched by the power of his apologetic. Do you see how intimate Paul becomes with him? He can see in the man's eyes that he's getting somewhere. Here was a man who believed the Bible. Here was a man who had a background of understanding of many of these things. He knew what Paul was saying was true. Otherwise, he would have swept it aside. And yet the sad truth is that Agrippa would not admit to himself or to anyone else the inner challenge he was feeling. Instead, he turns Paul aside with a non-committal and slightly embarrassed laugh. I'm afraid to say that is often the way it is. You know the story of the young student who said to the evangelist, "I've made up my mind. Now don't confuse me with facts." Lots of people like that. Sometimes it's pride that hinders them. It's humiliating to have to admit that you've been wrong about big things for a long while. Sometimes it's fear. What will all my influential friends think if I show signs of weakening in my unbelief about this Christianity business? But you know, as often as not, it is nothing more than inertia. That's the real problem for thousands of people. Moral inertia that isn't willing to change, intellectual inertia that isn't really willing to think. You must have heard the story of the man who went into his doctor one day and said, "Doctor, I'm dead." And the doctor said, "Nonsense, how can you be dead?" He said, I'm dead, doctor." So the doctor said to him, "Well, now listen, dead men don't bleed, do they?" "No," said the man, "dead men don't bleed." "Right then," he took his finger and he stuck a pin in it. "There, what's that?" he said. And the man thought for a little while and then he said, "Well, well, well, dead men do bleed." So committed, you see. There are some people so committed to their intellectual and moral inertia that no amount of argument, no amount of evidence will ever alter them. "You're not going to make a Christian that easily out of me, Paul." "I've made up my mind." And when you find that kind of intransigence, you see, there's only one thing left to try. Personal appeal. Which is legitimate, and which Paul now does. "Short time or long," he says, "I pray God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for these chains." Don't you find that moving? I'm quite sure that Agrippa did. And I'm appealing to you this morning. Every one of you who isn't a Christian here, I'm appealing to you. Thankfully, I wear no chains around my arms or ankles. Well, there are plenty of things about my life I wouldn't wish on you. Certainly wouldn't wish you to turn you into a Baptist pastor. Maybe that's worse than chains. But there is one thing I pray for you. I pray it every Sunday before I come into this pulpit. For every one of you who isn't a Christian, pray you may find the same faith I have. Because it's not madness, because it's true and reasonable. Because it's not a big hoax, because the evidence is there for you to see in the book and in the lives of Christians around you. And yet you see, every Sunday, you get up and you walk out just as Agrippa got up and walked out. And you make such polite comments about the sermon, and you say, "What a clever chap that preacher is." But you don't believe. You don't believe. You whisper under your breath, "It'll take more than that to make a Christian of me." Well, all right then, tell me. How much more will it take to make a Christian of you? How much longer are you going to continue in your non-Christian inertia? When are you going to pass beyond the questions you can't answer to that faith you can't deny? Tell me. How much more will it take to make a Christian of you? Let's pray together.